Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All this sucks. British Columbia, you ever been up here?
I've been up in like Alberta, Grand Prairie.
Oh yeah.
Kind of right on I think when I was in Alberta, we were maybe 5 miles from like the BC line.
Oh yeah.
So we're close.
Cool.
Good buddy of mine, Trevor Manteuffel, top of the Flyway Outfitters.
Right.
He's a duck goose guy up there. But yeah, I was up there filming some stuff for Ozonix a couple years back.
Yeah. Yeah. And I seen you're out in Saskatchewan there too, doing a moose hunt and, mm-hmm. and whitetail hunt. Got a big
dude. I love Canadians. I love Canada. It's funny, man. I had known Steve Eklund for a long time. And I used to always tease him, and I'm like, dude, you're my favorite Canadian. He's like, I'm the only Canadian, you know.
Yeah, there's not a lot of Canadians up here. It's funny when I talk to you guys down there, you know, I had one guest from California, and he didn't realize that there was more people in California state than there is in all of Canada. It kind of blew him away.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's hilarious, man. Yeah, I love it. I've had a good opportunity. I've hunted in Ontario, Saskatchewan, and then filmed up in Alberta.
So where are we hitting you up from today?
I'm in Iowa, Southeast Iowa. Most people are like, Southeast Iowa, where's that? I'm like, Lee and Tiffany are 15 miles down the road. And they're like, oh, yeah, I know where you're at.
Yeah, you know, I remember another Johnny Utah from, he played for the Ohio State Buckeyes.
That's it. He was. Yeah. Number 9, I believe, blew out his knee in that Rose Bowl game.
One of the best movies of all time.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where the nickname comes from.
No kidding, eh?
Yep. So in my previous career, I spent a year of 16 years in law enforcement, undercover narcotics. And I did a little bit of work with FBI Safe Streets. And when I was doing that, I told my business partner, I said, hey, you know, he's like, I've been trying to get a hold of you the past weeks, you know, a couple weeks, haven't heard from you. It's like, well, I've been doing some undercover stuff with FBI out of Cincinnati. And he goes, oh my God, you're the real Johnny Utah. The name just stuck, man.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, I know a bit about you, but for the listeners, maybe we can just start from the beginning and we'll kind of just lay it all down, you know, where you started from and all the way up to where you are now.
So grew up in central Kentucky, and that's horse racing, thoroughbred. And at the time, a lot of tobacco, you know, ag crop fields and stuff. And there wasn't a lot of whitetails in central Kentucky. And people are like, are you kidding me? Like, you're not 100 years old, you know, like, how's that possible? But there just wasn't a whole lot of whitetails. And so we didn't do it. My dad wasn't a hunter. And I think a lot of times people, when they get into hunting, it's more of a legacy thing because, you know, you need somebody to kind of teach it to you and show you what it is to either A, know how to do it, appreciate it, understand it. And then also the biggest thing is access, right? So we lived on 8 acres that was all cattle pasture, and there wasn't a single tree on the property. So hunting was not something that we did growing up. We fished. And it wasn't until after I moved to Northern Kentucky and I started my police career, one of my buddies was like, he's like, dude, we ought to get into deer hunting. And he was from Texas. So target rich environment, you know, down there. And I said, I don't know anything about deer hunting. It's like, how's that possible? He's like, you grew up in Kentucky, you know, you hillbillies are supposed to be all about eating roadkill and killing deer and, you know, eating possums and stuff. And I'm like, look, man, there are parts of Kentucky like that, but in my neck of the woods, it's all horse and cattle and we just don't have deer. So to age myself, I'm 44. I went to the public library, checked out books on how to be a whitetail hunter. Like it was like Whitetail 101 and secrets of whitetail hunting and things like that. And that's how I got into it initially. And like a lot of people, you know, I picked up a rifle first. That was the first thing that, you know, I did. And that was my introduction. And I did that for several years. And it got to the point where rifle hunting was almost becoming too easy. I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm an expert sniper, but I did receive some extra training, you know, via the government on how to shoot guns. And it got to the point where I was shooting whitetails where I felt these animals, they don't even know I exist on Earth at all. None whatsoever. This has gotten too easy. So, and I'm not bashing rifle hunting. That was just me and my pursuit and where I was at that time. So I figured that maybe bow hunting was something that I needed to do. And a buddy of mine at the local bow shop, he ended up giving me a bow simply because he just did not want me to get out of hunting. And I had a toddler at the, you know, at home. And I thought, man, if I try to go buy a bow and a sight and a rest and arrows and quiver, broadheads, my wife's probably going to divorce me and lock the doors. So he gave me a bow. And that helped me out a whole lot. And things just kind of took off from there and was bow hunting, but I was still very much like your weekend, not weekend hunter, but I might only whitetail hunt 2 weeks a year and it would be broken up, you know, over the 3 month season or something like that, you know? But, once we got into like, say 2013, I became a co-owner of a company called Wicked Tree Gear. And we manufactured hand saws and telescoping pole saws, and they're sold in Cabela's, Bass Pro, Field & Stream still to this day. And my business partner there, he had an online hunting show. It's called White Knuckle Productions. And it was between him and Todd Graff at bowhunting.com, or also known as Bow Hunt or Die, you know, video web show. Those were two of the earliest web shows really that were out there that were producing content, you know, habitually. And he asked me, he said, you ought to start filming your hunts. And I'm like, this is no, like, I'm not taking a camera. I hunt to hunt. I want to be outside. I want to be in it. I don't want to be thinking about, you know, having a video camera or is the animal in focus or, you know, hey, hunting's hard enough as it is, right? Yeah. So, but he talked me into doing it. And in 2013, I filmed my first velvet bow kill in Kentucky and loved it because I fell into, I don't have to tell my buddies about it. I could just like hit play and be like, look, there's no way that you can ever tell the story of a hunt that's going to paint the exact picture of how it was. And you know, like it is like when it's captured on video. And so I loved it, man. I fell into it. Things progressed. I made a lot of connections through owning Wicked. And then ultimately we sold Wicked. And that was when we sold Wicked, I had to make some choices. For the first year, I stayed on board with the company, the parent company that we sold Wicked to. They wanted me to stick around to help design new stuff and kind of be there through the transition process, right? Which is pretty normal, you know, with acquisitions nowadays. So I did that and continued to network and make more connections in the space. And then when that deal or contract per se ended, it was like, okay, now what am I going to do? I'm no longer a police officer. I retired from that. I didn't really want to continue doing that style of a hunting show. But in the meantime, I had picked up a camera and really taking to a liking to photography. So I thought maybe this is a business model that I could do and just start providing product lifestyle photography and not just grip and grins, you know, not the hero pics, but really provide these companies with the marketing that they need. And that was the thing that I noticed when I was with Wicked is I was always calling the people that we were sponsoring and I'm like, I need more content. And they're like, well, I just sent you a picture of my dead muley or my dead elk or my dead whitetail. And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't help me sell a handsaw whatsoever. Yeah. I need pictures of you using the handsaw or maybe a little video clip of how you trimmed a shooting lane or you trimmed access, you know, into your tree stand setup or something like that. I was like that, you know, I can't take the consumer and go A to Z. I need to show them A, B, C, D, E, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? I need to mm-hmm. show how this product works and let's do it in a good way through high quality, you know, photography. So, you know, they always talk about whatever business you start is going to solve a problem. And to me, that was a problem that I faced. So I thought, well, maybe other people are facing it too. So I started out doing product lifestyle a little bit on the side, and that kind of got the ball rolling to the point that I was ready to make that transition where I'm not making $1 million, but I can at least buy ramen noodles right now. So let's go ahead and do the leap of faith. I left that hunting show, started my own hunting show. And so that has been kind of the bread and butter, you know, of my revenue stream is having my hunting show and then doing freelance photography. I found a way to incorporate both of those worlds into what I do. And, you know, a lot of the marketing partners that I have that are on board with my show, you know, I'm not just selling usage on the show. You're not going to get, you know, you're not just seeing the product being used in episodes. I'm also providing them with physical, tangible photography assets that are their property and they get to use them. Because at the end of the day, I can't guarantee how many people are going to watch my show. And even if I'm providing them 1 million views, what's the conversion? You know, I don't know. But what I can guarantee is the value of that photo, you know? Right. So that's the way I've structured my contracts, and that has continued to parlay. And then a lot of my marketing partners have then come to me now and said, well, let's take it a step further. Because you do have a product design background, here's a new product we're thinking about launching, help us launch it. So I get to now, I've been able to start another business called Johnny Utah Creative, where I help do consulting and product design work and logo design work for clients. And then I can build the photo content around their launch for them, whether it be their magazine photography or brochure, catalog, trade show pictures, and things like that. Then, most recently, I started missing having a product. You know, I sold a product, you know, and I was like, I kind of like having a product of my own. And I'm already burning the candle at both ends. So what else can I do?
Why not start from the middle, eh?
Yeah. So I started a turkey call company, and which is one of the most saturated markets, you know, categories in the space, especially here in the lower 48. And I thought, I'm going to start a turkey call company, and I'm going to be very blunt and to the point. I'm going to call it Bourbon Barrel Calls, because all of the calls are made from reclaimed Kentucky bourbon barrel heads. So we're not cutting any new trees down. We're using a reclaimed wood source.
When you say head there, sorry. When you say head, is that the top, lid or the top? Gotcha.
Yeah. So you can call them lids, heads, you know, kind of the same, but, so I started sourcing these, and I'm, like I said, I'm from Kentucky. This is where bourbon, you know, came from. So, you know, we fancied up the Strikers and do a little wax dripped logo on the top of the Striker. And we offer some custom stuff as well that we do for a lot of companies. And, you know, like John Dudley with Knock On TV, he ordered like 110 of them last year. And, you know, Loophole, they ordered 50 of them. And, you know, a lot of times people will buy them for gifts, you know, and a lot of people thought it was a novelty thing. You know, they're like, oh, I'm buying this turkey call. And because the whole tie-in is that a lot of turkeys like to roost in oak trees. Mm-hmm. Bourbon, to be bourbon, it has to be held in a charred white oak wood barrel.
Oh, no kidding.
So there's the kind of the tie-in, right? Yeah. You know, yeah. With the source of the wood. And it's got a little bit of a green source to it because I'm not cutting down new trees to make these. $5 from every purchase also goes back to NWTF and an organization called the White Oak Initiative, which is a team of biologists that is dedicated to basically the reforestation of white oak trees, because through deforestation and just natural attrition, furniture making, roadways, neighborhoods, we're going to run out of white mature white oaks. And so That's been really cool to be a part of. And like I said, the call tells the story. They're all handmade. There's nothing made in a factory with robotics or lasers or, you know, any of that kind of stuff. I mean, absolutely every single call has been hand glued by me. And The business is about 2 years old and we've sold about 1400 calls so far.
Oh, why turkey calls? Like, did you have a background?
Yeah. Well, you know, growing up in Kentucky, turkeys and whitetails, those were the first two animals that I ever hunted. And that was in that early years of cutting my teeth, you know, in hunting, was whitetails and turkeys. And it's funny because I also had a conversation with a buddy and I said, you know, even in a saturated category, if you have a good product, you know, that's the number one thing. It has to be good quality. But number two, it also has to have a back end story. I said, I think you can pretty much make anything a go. And he made a comment. He's like, what about turkey calls? So I'm like, ooh, that's a saturated one right there. You know what I mean? You know, and how do you compete with all of the $29, you know, foreign, we'll call them foreign made calls from other countries that are being shipped in for pennies on the dollar? I said, what if you do a handmade call, do them limited runs? I'm never going to compete with, you know, a $30 turkey call. That's not going to happen. But if somebody wants something special that's handmade and tells a good backstory, I think it'll work. So it was kind of like, all right, bet, you know, let's see if it'll go. And it's, I tell you, the other thing that it's done is, you know, I get a lot of people that say, man, it seems like, you know, you're kind of scattered. You got your hands on a lot of different things. You know, you have the hunting show and you're doing freelance photography and you're doing marketing consulting. And then you have Bourbon Barrel turkey calls. But if you think about it,
sorry. Are you married? You got wife and kids at home?
Yeah.
Okay.
Married.
Okay.
Yeah. Married 22 years, three kids.
Okay. I had to ask because I have three kids and a wife. And I mean, that is a lot for some people alone. Never mind.
Yeah.
All the other hats you got going on there.
Yeah. So if you start putting all the pieces of the puzzle together, because of Bourbon Barrel calls, I have a leg up because I do have a product design background. And I understand packaging and I understand that side of it. I'm able to build my own website. I'm able to do my own photography for the business. So I'm not spending any money, you know, there. The other part of it is through marketing, as I learn different things about promoting my own business, I can then now take that to my other clients of Johnny Utah Creative and say, hey, here's an ad spin that I did with Bourbon Barrel and it worked very well. Let's try it for your company. Or here's a way that I launched this product and I think we can do the same style to launch your product. The other part of it is with my hunting show, Primal Divide, I now have a free platform to promote my calls on. 100% for free. Bourbon Barrel doesn't have to pay John Mulligan, you know, to do that. So right out of the gate, the first thing I did when I launched the turkey calls is I took one of my calls and I did a single season archery grand slam in 1 month. And, you know, just used one of my calls on all four different species. And, you know, like I said, archery in a month, single season grand slam. And there's a lot of people that have been trying to do that with a shotgun for a lifetime.
Right.
So that gave me a lot of content right out of the gate to help launch that business. And it was great content for my hunting show too. Mm-hmm. So all of these things from the outside looking in, it looks like I'm scattered, but they all feed off of each other.
Right. There's a method there.
So that's me, man. That brings us pretty much up to speed as to where I'm at. And you know, now the bow hunting has evolved into all animals, you know, and you know, Canada, lower 48, all over. I even recently went back to doing a little bit of rifle hunting as well after taking like 15 years off of doing rifle hunts. I've done a little bit of rifle hunting again. And like I said, I have nothing against it. It was just, that was my pursuit at that time. And that's what I enjoyed doing. But you know, I'm also aware that sometimes when producing a show, I've only got 3 or 4 days to hunt and maybe I could get it done. But sometimes that rifle can speed up some of those hunts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sometimes there's just animals that they're almost just virtually impossible to get into close range on the ground, you know, with a bow.
Oh yeah, definitely, man. Work more hours. Where did that come from?
Yeah. So when I was a teenager,
obviously, I guess when you're wearing as many hats as you do, you got to find a way to work more hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that was the thing. When I was a kid, I went to my dad. I was trying. So in Kentucky, you have to be 16 to get a driver's license. So I was probably 14, 14 and a half. And I went to my dad and I said, hey, you know, I got this 16th birthday coming up in a year, you know what I mean? 2 years away. and I want to start saving money now so I can buy a car when I turn 16. And he said, well, you just got to work more hours. And I'm like, what? I'm like, there's no like get rich quick scheme you can teach me, or there's no tips you can tell me about. And he's like, look, man, anything worth having, anything worth earning, you can spend a lot of time thinking of all the different ways that you can shorten the learning curve and do this, do that. But the easiest way is just to put your head down and just get to work, you know. Yeah. And as I got older, that same motto, then I learned it transitioned to everything in life. I mean, I'm very happy that I've been married 22 years and it took work. You know, there's ups and downs in marriages mm-hmm. and everything that we do in life. And you can't be willing to give up so easy. And so that took work. And, you know, I'm huge, big into fitness and going to the gym all the time. I mean, that's a big, big, huge, huge part of my life. Maybe the number one principle of my life. And it takes time. You're not going to go to the gym tomorrow and be in shape.
No,
but going to the gym every single day over the course of a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you know what I mean? It you know, it takes time. And if somebody's religious or they want to improve their connection with their faith, it doesn't happen overnight. But, you know, if you have strong moral values and every day you're better today than you were yesterday, then you start moving the needle, you know, over time. Yeah. So that's been my whole thing. It's just work more hours. And it's funny because I also have another company called Work More Hours and we sell apparel. And that business was set up as a fundraiser. My father passed away about a year and a half ago.
Oh, fair year. So,
thank you. And so we started a memorial fund, basically. So this company is what feeds that memorial fund. So it's kind of a nonprofit because I don't take a dollar out of it.
Yeah.
But it's not technically a 501c3. But so we sell apparel and then we do a big memorial race, stock car race every year.
Oh, cool.
That pays the purse for that down in Kentucky. And my dad was a big race fan. And
you're a racer or something.
Oh, yeah. I used to race dirt late models myself. Number 19 tattooed on. That was my race car number.
Badass.
Yeah. So I drove dirt late model stock cars and competitively, you know, competed in that. And I tell you, there's nothing like sliding sideways with a 900 horsepower motor.
That's one of my bucket list things, man, is to go watch a NASCAR race.
Yeah. So I did that. And my dad was a huge racing fan and car owner. He owned a lot of cars over the years. And he was just kind of a staple at those dirt tracks, you know, back home in Kentucky. So kind of the grassroots of racing where it all started. And so we host a big race every year. Last year, we had a $10,000 to win race down in Kentucky at this track called Ponderosa Speedway, which is ironically where I won my first feature event at as well. So it's cool. That's coming up July 8th. And that's actually on my list to do this week, is to start calling and soliciting some support and start getting that information out there on that race. Last year, it was standing crowd. I mean, there was probably 400 people that didn't have seats in the bleachers that were just having to stand around the fence and watch the race. And it was awesome, man. It was crazy, yeah. Crazy turnout. They sold a lot of hot dogs and funnel cakes that night at the concession stand.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet. So, it's been a long wait too after COVID and all that BS that was going on. So,
it's good to see, man. Been so nice. Yeah. Getting everybody back together again and doing stuff outdoors and,
yeah,
you know, mask free and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's been a ton of fun. And, so that's where the work more hours comes from. And it's been kind of my mantra motto. It's the basis of everything that I do. And, I try to teach people. And a lot of times people ask me, they say, work more hours. Well, I'm trying to work less hours. That's crazy. You know, you work till you die. And I'm like,
wrong kind of work.
Thinking about it from 9 to 5 aspect. And I said, if you put in a bunch of time, energy, and effort into your marriage, what is that called? Well, putting in work. Oh, there mm-hmm. you go. Just mm-hmm. work more hours. You know, it's all you can do. And I think that is one thing that I've also seen as a dad with my children, that one of the key differences that I've seen in generations is, you know, I was taught that it might take time.
Yeah.
You might not get to your goal tomorrow. Whereas my kids, they kind of think that if they're going to get good at something, if in 5 minutes, if they're not good at it, they're just ready to give up.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you there.
So that's kind of been one of those things that I've really tried to teach my kids is if your goal is to make it to the NBA, that's not good. If your goal is to enjoy the game of basketball and enjoy playing every day, mm-hmm. you got a chance.
Yeah.
Because even if you don't reach the goal, at least you're not going to be disappointed. You had fun on the journey.
Yeah.
So I was like, you have to enjoy the walk more so than the destination, I guess is another way of putting it.
Yeah. It's funny. I find the exact same thing now. You know, I'm 43 myself. I got three kids and we were always taught if you want something, you're going to have to work for it. You're going to have to earn it. Nothing's going to be given to you in this life for free. It's not going to be handed to you. Yeah. And it's funny, you know, I find even with the guys that work for me, the younger generation, they just expect everything to be handed to them. And if it's not instant, they don't want anything from it. They have no gratification of any hard work or, you know, that's one thing I struggle with my kids is, I got to just pound it into him, you know, hey, if you want this, enjoy it. Like my son's heavy into baseball now. He's just get into it. I'm like, listen, you can achieve anything you want out of baseball, but you have to want it. Only you can push yourself to do it. And you got to try your hardest and you got to finish it, man.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Yeah. It's just a different time, man. It's crazy how much it's changed in, you know, I mean, 30 years or so. It's hopefully we don't lose that. I know that, you know, and it's funny because there's a lot of parents that just they're okay with it. You know, I find a lot of parents, they're okay with, you know, okay, well, you know, that's fine. You started it. You don't have to finish it. It's okay. You know, it's good enough. It's good enough.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's a bad precedent to start. I remember when I was a kid and I wanted to play soccer physically. I probably had a really good build for soccer. I was decent at it, but I wasn't great at it. And I remember going to my dad one time and I was like, I think I want to quit soccer. Like, this isn't fun. And the reason why it wasn't fun is because I wasn't as good as I hoped I would be. And I didn't have that mindset right. You know, I wasn't enjoying the game for the game. I only wanted to play because I thought I was going to kick ass and dominate. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's like, no, you can't quit. I'm like, what? He said, because that'll start a precedent that anything you don't want to do in life or it's not going your way, it's just so easy to quit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so he made me stick it out. Same thing, you know, anytime I wanted to play football, I wanted to play basketball or golf or whatever. So I was very thankful that my parents, you know, and I say this to my kids all the time. I was like, the difference between me and you is my parents didn't raise a quitter. They wouldn't let me be a quitter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anytime they want to play a sport or pick up an activity, I'm like, that's fine. But you're not going to just give up on it tomorrow if it doesn't go well. No, no, Dad, I'm telling you, like, I want to do this. I'm like, well, then you're going to do it. You know what I mean? Like, you're not going to quit. I'm not letting you quit.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And that's the biggest thing. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a kid or an adult, if it's fitness, working out, hunting, anything you do, you're only going to get out of it what you put into it. And, you know, I see it all the time with guys hunting. From the beginning, they're looking at it on Instagram. They're seeing big bucks going down. They're seeing, you know, moose and whatever, right? Whatever they're looking at, whatever they set their goal on. And then they get their, you know, they get their hunting license, they get a firearm or a bow. Usually they start with a firearm. And then they get into it and they're like, oh, it's too hard. I'm just not going to do it anymore. And you're like, well, I mean, you're looking at pictures. You didn't see the lifetime of hard work and sweat that the guys put it into getting that. Mm-hmm. You're just looking at the end game. And that's the problem. Yeah. You need to look long term. And if you quit now, you're never going to get to where you want to get if you don't put the hard work and sweat in.
One of my videographers, he's fairly new to hunting, only done it a few years, but collectively over those 3 years, probably has hunted a third of what I hunt in a single year. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I've seen him get frustrated with not having success in the field. And I sat him down one day and just kind of had a talk with him. And I said, dude, you got to think about this for a second. Yes, I've only been doing this hardcore for 10 years, but you didn't see the 10 years, 12 years prior to that when I wasn't killing anything. And even the first few years of this 10-year period, I was killing maybe one buck a year, maybe two turkeys and a buck, or you know, something like that. And I said, you're seeing where I'm at now after 20 years of kicking ass, you know, and grinding it out, you know, to get to where I'm at. So you can't compare where you're at in hunting with where I'm at in hunting. Instead, what you need to do is you need to look at it more as, man, I'm getting some dope opportunities to get to go hunt with John and learn and see some of this stuff that he's doing and how his approach is not a comparison.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because having a mentor is nothing to take for granted. And it's funny because I had a great mentor. I had many great mentors growing up, and I took them for granted. And it's funny, now I see in the industry how much that's lacking in hunting. That information and just everything about it, the work ethic you get from mentorship, is absolutely nothing to take for granted in any means.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely, you're correct. And I didn't have a lot of those mentors, you know, my buddy that I hunted with that from Texas, you know what I mean? That wanted to be a deer hunter. I don't think he had ever killed a whitetail either himself. So we were both like learning from these books, and I'll never forget, and not to bash Walmart or anything like that, you know, our version of Canadian Tire, which in my opinion, Canadian Tire is way better than Walmart. Like, I went to Walmart and I'm like, okay, I need camouflage. And I just grabbed some stuff off the shelf, and I didn't know anything about layering or anything like that. I froze my butt off. It was the most miserable experience of my life. So there's so many things that you learn that whether you have to do it on your own, and it does help if you've got somebody to teach, you know, learning curve and learn that learning curve from to expedite some things. But it's a hard thing to learn. And, you know, you can study and having, like you said, having a mentor is huge, but also at the end of the day, it's just time, you know, you have to mess up that hunt 50 times before you learn, okay, let's not do that again. You know what I mean? And there's nothing, I don't think anybody can really teach you.
No.
You know, you have to learn it. You have to see it on your own, you know?
Oh yeah. But, absolutely, man.
I like that quote. It's, you know, don't bitch about the results you didn't get from the work you didn't do.
I like that too. Never heard that before, but that's a good one.
Yep. Yep. And, so I say that to my kids all the time. You know, my oldest, he runs track and cross country, and he's like, I didn't have a really good time this week or whatever. And I said, yeah, well, you didn't go, you skipped a couple of morning runs, you skipped an afternoon run, and, you know, stuff like that. And I was like, you know, there you have it.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, like in my household growing up, there was no, there's no dessert with skipping dinner. So,
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, and now granted, I'm very appreciative of my parents and the upbringing that I had as a general work ethic perspective and very loving home. There was never a lack of anything like that. But you know, my dad was kind of old school in the sense where I remember as a freshman in high school, I finished like second in a regional varsity meet, which meant grade 9, I was competing against grade 12, and we were in a big region, a lot of schools, 20, 22 different schools in this region. And I finished second, and I mean, I was ecstatic, you know, here I am grade 9 and, you know, almost won this race, and I'm jumping up and down. I'm hysterically happy. My mom, she's almost in tears. The coach is like, you're the man, you know, all my teammates are all proud. And my dad's like, what are you so happy for? You didn't win. And I was like, I went from 10 to 0, you know what I mean? And I was like, I really hate you right now. You know, that's like the meanest thing to ever say, but I get it. You know, he was very old school, and he came from that cloth where he was just wanting me to never settle for second.
Yeah.
You know, he always wanted to make sure that I had that desire to be the best. And there's a lot of that is still in me today.
Well, yeah, so it's apparent.
I can, Yeah. And I compete with myself so much. I don't care what anybody else is doing. You know, they could have better farm than I did. They could have, you know, larger genetics access. I've been in those lucky situations where it's just dumb luck, right place, right time, the deer walked by. Mm-hmm. We've all, if you do it long enough, you'll get lucky every once in a while.
Yeah.
And you got to capitalize on those because they don't happen all that often. So I've been in those situations where, but I never try to compete with anybody else, you know, with what I see everybody else doing. I really try to compete.
Which is good though, because I think if you only compete with if you're just competing with yourself, there's no bar you're going to set and you're not going to reach that bar and then be like, okay, that's good enough. If you're always competing against yourself, there's always room to be better. Now that doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're working out, lifting weights, if it's hunting, especially with hunting, right?
Yeah.
There's always room for improvement. And hunting is a game of mistakes. You're only going to, like you mentioned earlier, the only way you actually learn, and like having a good mentorship is important because he's going to teach you, you know, base layering. He's going to teach you about optics and, you know, guns and all that stuff. But you're only going to learn those hard lessons by making those mistakes for yourself. And that comes to hard work and just time spent. And that's it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. No, that's spot on. And, you know, and I've had people ask me, like, what is your goal? I'm like, I don't have one. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, you got to have a goal. No. Because it's always moving.
Right. Yeah.
I'm never going to reach the finish line ever.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. Exactly. And that's the thing is like when you were working undercover, your goals might have been one thing, but now they've evolved into something else. So that exactly by having no goal, no bar to set, you're always striving, you're always reaching, you're always working to improve and for something else. And life is different, right? When you're 20 years old, you have different goals than you do when you're 40 years old. So
yep, that's exactly right. And you know, and I might set these little small tiered goals that are trackable, you know, for me. And it might be, you know, public land, archery, spot and stock, you know, bull elk or, you know, something like that in Wyoming or, you know, in Montana or something like that. I might have little goals and little life goals, little bucket list hunts. You know, this year I'm going to scratch a couple of those by heading to Africa. That's been something I've always wanted to do. And the funny thing about Africa is I always thought it was cool and the animals were cool, but I didn't really have this big desire to go. And then what's happened over the years is now I have this desire that I want to photograph Africa I want to see the orphanages and I want to see where this meat goes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And that's the story that I want to tell. The animals are just a byproduct. You know, the hunt is just a byproduct of that I want to go and check out how hunting, you know, has contributed to their economy and stuff like that. So, and it's just an awesome experience, right? I mean, those are my little life goals that kind of keep me on pace. But the ultimate goal, like you said, it's ever evolving. It's changing constantly. It's moving. It's not a steadfast hard line. And that's what I love about hunting is you can never reach the ultimate goal.
Never.
No.
Never.
So I like that, you know, and some people that intimidates. You know, about not ever, what do you mean? You can never reach the finish line. You know, this is the dumbest thing in the world. No, this is great. And I think a lot of that comes with maturity, you know, as you get older and also not caring about anything else other than your, you know, what your goal is, your mission and competing with yourself. And I think that has a lot to do with it too. And it's just a great thing, you know, especially considering that it wasn't that I didn't grow up doing, you know, I got into hunting very late. I was 21 years old, I think, when I bought my first hunting license. So, man, I wish I would have started when I was a kid, but,
it's one of those things that, you know, it might be different if you did, maybe it would have been different than it is now for you. So,
I might not have had the appreciation, you know, and I might not have looked at things the way that I look at them, you know, because I didn't really get into bow hunting until I was probably 28, 29. And, I think sometimes maybe it takes a little bit of maturity.
Yeah.
You know, on your, to get into something like that on your own, you know, I didn't have influence from buddies to be like, this is the bow hunter lifestyle, or, you know, this is the meaning of this. This is why we do this.
Yeah.
I didn't have anybody to ingrain, you know, some of those thoughts. So I think getting into something by yourself, I think it does, you have to be a little older or a little bit more mature to understand and appreciate some of those things. So, I mean, I'm glad the way it's all worked out. I love to see where things are going next. And everybody says, what are you looking forward to? And my response is usually the next hunt.
Yeah.
But whatever's the next hunt, that's what I'm looking forward to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how you talk about getting into bow hunting a little later on in life. Bow hunting is something that takes, if you're not a bow hunter, you don't understand it, or you don't appreciate the discipline it takes. I mean, just archery itself, you know, the complexity of it. I mean, to learn that by yourself, I mean, that's something else, because like I learned from a great shooter. And so, you know, I didn't have, you know, a lot of mistakes that I would have, that maybe someone like yourself went through. I didn't have to go through them. So, I mean, it takes a lot of discipline to overcome that and to get to be a good bow hunter. And a lot of people just give up. And I find that even present today, a lot of people are like, ah, it's just too hard. You know, it'd be really cool to be a bow hunter, but it's just too hard.
Yeah. I'll just grab a crossbow.
Exactly. Right. And you're like, okay. But I'm going to tell you, it's not as cool as being a bow hunter.
No, it's amazing. It's, and I've learned so much more as far as patience and restraint and the appreciation. And I can see I can see the deer's nose twitch at 20 yards. I can't see that happen at 400 yards.
No.
And again, not taking anything away from rifle hunting, because a 400, 500, 600 yard shot, that comes with its own skill set, you know, as well. But for me, it'll always be my preferred method of a weapon is always going to be a bow. But like I said, I do enjoy some, you know, some rifle hunts. My moose that I shot in Saskatchewan back in December, that was with the rifle. I had my bow in my hand and there was about 175 yards or meters, between me and the moose. And he was bedded down in a clearing with about 4 foot of snow. They had also timbered this field, which is why it was a clearing, but they had not picked the logs up yet. Imagine just a bunch of Lincoln logs sprinkled underneath 4 foot of snow. Yeah. And that's what's between me and him. And I'm going, okay, I can stick my chest out, grab my bow and start this stalk and completely blow it, which is inevitably what is 110% going to happen. Or I can try to wait him out and it's negative 31 degrees Fahrenheit and I'll just die of hypothermia waiting on this, this moose. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I thought, that's not a valid option. Ethically, I can pick up this Bergara 308 that I know is zeroed in and I can take this moose right here, right now. And that's what I opted to do. And it took about 2 seconds to come to that decision. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And have no regrets. Someday, would I like to go after a big Alaska moose or something with my bow? 100%. Big Yukon moose. That'd be phenomenal. But in that time and place for that particular hunt, that was the right call. That was the ethical call to make. And I love it. Can't wait to get back from the taxidermist.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. That's a beast. What kind of, what are you going to do for taxidermy? You doing a shoulder mount?
Yeah. Shoulder.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
Yep,
yeah. That'd be cool.
So yeah, I'm excited about that. And, you know, in just 2 days prior to that, I had taken a really nice Saskatchewan whitetail with my bow, a nice 5.5 year old buck. I send all my teeth in. So whenever if I say the age, it's only confirmed by teeth. If I say, I think he was this, then I'm just guessing, but he was a 5.5 year old buck. And even got the matched set of sheds from him.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. From the spring prior. Yeah. One of the guides, he really liked one of my knives when we were breaking down my moose and he's just kept commenting. He's like, man, this is a really, really nice knife. I really like this. And I said, well, just keep it. And he's like, no, we don't do that here, but I'll barter, I'll trade you for it. And I was like, well, what do you got to trade? You know? And he's like, you like sheds? And I'm like, I love sheds. I'm a huge, you know, shed hunter. So he says, I've got a nice set of chocolate sheds. Then I'll give you a match set. And I was like, yeah, cool, fair trade, whatever. I was going to give him the knife anyways, you know? Yeah. So yeah. I'm coming out ahead. And anyways, he gives me the sheds the next day and I'm looking at them and I'm like, wait a second. And I take them over to my skull cap, you know, buck that was in my hotel room. And I was like, do you realize this is the match set from that buck, you know? And he goes, well, you know, now that I think about it, he's like, I did find him about 200 yards from where you killed your buck. And I was like, but you didn't know? And he's like, no, I didn't. This wasn't like a joke or anything. So just kind of weird happenstance that it worked out like that. But
yeah,
so well, that's always that added to it. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. What are some of the differences between the Saskatchewan bucks and the bucks you used to hunt at home?
Bigger. I mean, bigger. And you know, in Iowa, we've got some of the biggest bucks, probably the biggest bucks, you know, in the United States, you know, Minnesota, upper Wisconsin, Iowa, you know, cold weather bucks anyways. Yep. So we have larger body deer, much bigger than like your Florida deer and Texas, way bigger than the Texas deer. But, so that was one of the biggest thing that I noticed. And then also, it seems like with a lot of the big pines, you know, you're going to get those chocolate racks. And even before I was really a hunter, can call myself a hunter, I would watch some of the Saturday morning hunting shows and I'd see like real tree buck, you know, monster bucks and stuff like that. And they would be up in Saskatchewan and I'm like, oh my gosh, I was like in awe of how dark chocolate racked, you know, those antlers were. And a lot of times they would be filming a buck and they're like, oh my gosh, this is a buck that we want to take. And they would shoot it. And I'm going, man, I mean, I thought bucks in Saskatchewan were supposed to be big, like his rack, you know, in comparison to rack to the body, like he really wasn't that big. And then they would do their big reveal, you know, video clip. Yeah. And I'm like, holy crap, that's a 200 inch whitetail. You know, it's just the bodies are so big. It made the rack look small.
Yeah.
And very much the case with my buck. So I kind of knew that, you know, ahead of time. And I mentally, I kind of told myself, I'm like, you could probably add 10 inches to every buck that you see, you know, what he's actually going to be. But I sat out there, we sat in a blind and, it was day two, we were doing bell to bell sits, you know, and had a little Mr. Buddy heater just to kind of
break the frost off. A little.
But everybody's like, does that Mr. Buddy heater help? And I'm like, like that's debatable.
It's funny because at the time, at the time, it doesn't seem like it's helping, but I think it does help a little bit.
Oh, just
keep that little bite off you.
Yep. And this buck came out and he was just super wide out past his ears. Nice. And he had the big sway back and he had the big jowls, you know, underneath his jaw. And I was like, this is a big mature deer. And I don't know. He's 4+, you know, that part I wasn't aware of, but yeah. So he ended up being a 5.5-year-old and we think, the moose, I popped out one of the teeth. It fell in the snow, forever.
Yeah.
And then the second lower incisor, I popped out and it broke. And so anyways, I sent what I had to the lab and they just said, look, it's just not enough to sample. But we, you know, we like to definitively age the tooth. We don't like to do guesses. And I'm like, well, since you can't definitively tell me, give me a guess.
Yeah.
And they said, if we guessed, we're going to say 8.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So anyways, but yeah, nice moose. He was about 47 inches wide.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen a picture of it. It's a good bull.
Saskatchewan's a good. Yeah. Good.
Oh yeah, man. Bull. Yeah. Was that your first bull moose?
Yeah. Yeah. First one. Yeah. First Saskatchewan whitetail, first moose ever. And then my only other experience hunting in Canada is I was up around that Nipigon River, Ontario area.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So absolutely as far east from you as you can possibly go, just about. I went up there on a bear hunt, archery bear hunt, and I need to have him officially entered. He's been scored. I've just never officially entered him, but according to our research, he'll be the number 5 all-time archery Ontario black bear.
Oh, nice. Wicked. Yeah, there's some big bears out there. Same with Saskatchewan, Manitoba. They get some big black bears out there.
Yeah,
we don't get them that big in BC. I think just because the competition from all the other stuff, you know, the Grizzlies, the Wolves,
and
everything else.
Yeah, so that's pretty wild. Well, I was up in, I was up in Alberta filming some stuff for a client, and while we were hunting, we came out we walked in dark, and we came out at daylight. And after the hunt that morning, and there's this big billboard. And I was like, what in the world are they advertising in the middle of nowhere? Like, what business is dumb enough to make a big billboard and advertise? Because you might see three cars all day drive past it. And it said, "Welcome to Grizzly Country. Be careful. And I'm going, oh, crap, you know. And so I asked the outfitter that we were staying with, I said, "Do you guys have a lot of grizzlies?" He's like, "No, you don't have to worry about that. You know, they just put those signs up." And I said, "Okay, whatever." So I go to my phone and I'm flipping through like the local news, and it's like, man eaten in his tent from grizzly in Alberta. And so I said, "Dude, there's a grizzly that just ate a dude in his tent last night." And he's like, "What does it say?" And I forget the town name, but I told him the town name, and he's like, "Ah, that's like super far from here. You don't have to worry about that." So curiosity gets the best of me, and I type it into my map to see where it's at. It's 17 miles away. I'm like, "You're so full of crap." I'm like, "Dude, that grizzly bear could have been hunting with us this morning." You know what I mean? So
yeah, grizzlies, they kind of just they kind of do their own thing. They kind of do what they want.
I was that big, I would too.
yeah, it's funny because like when I moved, I'm from northern BC, the north coast of BC, and up there you get big grizzlies, like big grizzlies. And down here, the grizzly bears are big, but they're not nearly as big as they are up north. And even you get the brown bears along the coast, they get pretty big. And
those things freak me out.
Yeah, they're intimidating, but I mean, a 300-pound black bear is going to mess you up too, right? So I've had run-ins with grizzly bears and some close calls with black bears. And I tell you, man, you know, you got to check your shorts after both of them, because, you know, either one of them are going to mess you up.
Now, I know that the black bears will do a lot of bluff charging and they pop their jaws and that kind of stuff. Do grizzlies do bluff charges, or do they just charge?
No, they'll do the same thing. I mean, they act the same way.
They'll huff and puff
and sit there, and they'll gnaw their jaw at you and stuff like that. But I've had instances where I've had to release bear spray on brown bears.
Oh, crap.
Yeah, we've had some close calls. We were on a goat hunt in the Kootenays a few years back, and we were coming out of this drainage. And the guy I was with, he was in front of me, and we were walking down the side of an old avalanche chute. We didn't want to walk up the middle of, because it was really loose shale. And it was high grass and plateaued ridges on the other side. And it was really nasty and slippery to walk up. So we just said, "Hey, let's just walk up this. We'll walk up the side of this rock chute. And that way, we still have the ability to jump off the rock, off the old landslide and into the grassy area if rock started to slide down." So we're about halfway up, and we're walking up this slide, and all of a sudden he's like, "Hey, shh, shh, shh." So I stop, and it sounded like there was a barrel, an old log, like a log rolling down the hill towards us. And then just as I look up, I seen something in the corner of my eye jump towards us. And I duck and roll out of the way, and it goes flying past us. And I mean, I barely seen it. It could have been a giraffe for all I know, right? Like, it was so close. So all I remember is that we get up, and then within 20 seconds, we're halfway up this chute, standing in the middle of it, looking down below, right? And we can hear the bear down there grumbling away, just going, "Oh," it messed itself up. It just basically came right at us, and then it went over the side of it went down that rock slide. And so we're sitting there looking at it, and we're like, we're both shitting ourselves, right? We're looking at it. And then, but now that by this time we got our guns out, we got, you know, we got a chamber rack, and we're like, "Okay, well, let's just wait here to see what happens." Cause we didn't want to turn our backs and find out. So we sat there for a bit, and we could hear it moaning and moaning. I was like, "Okay, well, let's just walk back to where we were, and we'll quickly get up the side of this hill." We walk back up, and then we look down, and we can see he had a kill there. He or she had a kill not far from where we were, and we were walking up towards it. And we just got too close to its kill, and then it just came right at us. But like I said, man, I just remember that black, dark brown coming at me. And the guy I was with, he's like, "Yeah, that was a grizzly. It came charging right for us." So, but yeah, Yeah, crazy stuff. And you got to give me respect.
Big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're huge.
I think, like, so my black bear was 545.
Huge.
And like, people don't understand, you know, like, how truly big that is.
Yeah, it's massive.
You know, they're thinking like, oh, what if it's like a 500 pound human or something like that? And I said, no, like, this thing's on all fours and they're just so enormous, you know. Yeah, they're just so big and they're so powerful that I don't think people understand. And there was a video clip that somebody had sent me, and it was maybe a 175, maybe 200 pound black bear that had caught a pig in a wild boar.
Uh-huh.
And just bit a hold of it and just started walking it up this mm-hmm. hill. Mm-hmm. It was a very, very steep incline, and it's, you know, 100 pound pig. And I go, can you pick up a 100 pound dumbbell or 100 pound weight in your mouth and just walk it up a hill?
How about just pick it up and walk up a hill?
Yeah. Right, enough. Period. Yeah. Yeah. And I said, so just think of the raw power that it takes to do that.
Yeah, man.
And these are apex predators. And then you, like you said, you go into the brown bears and you go into the grizzlies. Like, those things are freakishly, freakishly scary big. Like, we're talking nightmare shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. 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 Like I said, the grizzlies and the brown bears, I mean, for the most part, bears are bears, and you know, a 300 pound black bear is going to mess you up, but grizzlies they're engineered a little differently than the black bear. You know, they got those big, nasty claws.
Yeah.
They just have raw power. Like, they can easily drag away 1,100 pound moose. No problem. Just drag it away. Yeah. Like, it's nothing. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's insane.
It's so wild. I went on a trip a few summers ago, Jason Matzinger and Sam Sohol, a couple of guys, we all went on this trip on Sam's big public land bus. And we started out fly fishing in Idaho and then Utah and then ended up Big Sky, Montana. And once we got into to Montana, we stopped through Yellowstone and we went to that Bear and Wolf Discovery Center. And they've got a couple of captured grizzlies that they, you know, rehabbed and were injured. And, you know, they nursed him back. And this one big grizzly, his name was Sam. And I'll never forget, Sam's claws were the size of bananas.
Yeah.
Each claw was a banana.
Yeah.
You know, so to put that in perspective, to scale, you know, how big this thing was. And it's just lumbering along, lumbering along. And I'm like, this is the freakiest thing I've ever seen. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, that to me is a horror movie.
Yeah. And it blows you away as how agile they are for something
big. It looks like they're slow.
Yeah.
Like I said, they're just lumbering along, but when it's time to, you know, shit and get, I mean, they're quick, you know?
Yeah. 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 So, and they know their top dog too. I mean, it's pretty amazing seeing those things. They're fun to watch too. I mean, I'll stop and watch, you know, glass grizzly bears and watch them all day. No problem.
Sure. Yeah. And I've never seen one. I mean, even when I killed my black bear, I was about 10 foot off the ground in a tree. And I had taken a hang on tree stand on a piece of crown land, mm-hmm. you know, public land. Yeah. You're also public land. But it just climbed up about 10 feet. And I would have gone higher, but the rest of the tree above me was dead. I didn't know it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, crap, this is as high as I really want to go. And I mean, you know, the bear, I've got my bear. He's full mounted, you know, standing, not aggressive.
Yeah.
But I've got him standing with his paw, like around like an aspen. He's just taking a little break or whatever. And I mean, the top of his ears are touching my 8 foot ceiling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a big bear.
I tell people, I was like, I'm 10 foot off the ground in a tree. Like, if he wanted me, I was done.
Yeah.
He could have me. He probably could have just pushed my tree over. You know what I mean? But even if he wanted to just stand up on his hind legs, he could have just swiped my tree stand and knocked me out of the tree anyways.
Yeah. Well, and what's crazy about those black bears is they have the claws to climb the tree, where like a grizzly bear, it's just got those straight, sharp razor blade, like banana, like claws. Yeah. And it can't dig them into a tree, where a black bear, it still has access to a tree. So no matter where you are, you're really not that safe. So
no, it's just it's wild. And I remember after I shot my bear, I went and got some Tim Hortons, got a little double action.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I sent a message to old Steve Eklund and you know, sent him a couple of pictures of it and stuff like that. And he was ecstatic. He was pretty happy for me. So
yeah, no doubt. Yeah. He just got a polar bear.
I saw that. Yeah. I haven't talked about
top dog.
Yeah.
Fucking polar bear.
Yeah. Now, what is the rules on polar bears? Can you import those to Canada? Because I don't think
we. Well, he got it in Canada, so he got it in the Northwest Territories. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Cool.
There might be a few in the northeastern end of the Yukon, but for the most part, they do most of the polar bear hunting in the Northwest Territories. So.
Gotcha. Yeah, because I didn't know exactly where he got it from.
Yeah. Now you guys can't. You guys aren't allowed.
Correct.
To bring them into the United States. So what they do is they do mannequins and stuff. So you're not allowed to bring the hide or anything back to the United States. So they have to do just like but apparently they're really good at it. So apparently just they can
full blown replicas.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
that's pretty wild.
Yeah. You want to talk about a big bear. Yeah.
Old Stevie E, he's a character. Do you know Steve very well?
A bit. Yeah. 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 Chat a bit, but yeah.
He's a character. And I tell you, I would say on percentage, and not just because I'm doing this podcast with you, I'll be totally truthful. On percentage, Canadians to Americans, you guys are batting 1,000. Every Canadian I've ever met is like always like the coolest guy. They're super chill, laid back. And probably most of them are hunters. So that kind of helps, you know. But yeah, I love going to Canada every chance I get. I love hanging out with Canadians. I love hunting and telling stories and hearing stories from Canada, and I always keep a lot of loonies and toonies in my pockets whenever I go, and never know.
Yeah, well, that's good, man. It's funny too you say that, because I mean since I started this podcast, I get the pleasure of talking to a lot of you guys down there, and I'm gonna say the same thing about you guys there. Mm-hmm. So pretty cool.
I think that's the deal. We like you, you guys like us, we just don't like each other here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, right. But on that note, John, I'm going to wrap this up. So maybe just run through your list of where all the Canadian folks can find you and follow you and all that jazz.
Yeah, yeah. So Instagram, johnny.utah.hunt. That's going to be your most up-to-date, you know, day-to-day type content. My show is called Primal Divide, and you can actually watch that on the Waypoint TV network. So anybody that has Chromecast, Sling TV, Pluto, Roku, Amazon, you can watch it straight there, or you can just download the app on any smart TV or tablet device and watch it. After the shows premiere on Waypoint, then I put them on my YouTube channel, which is also called Primal Divide. But and if you're into turkeys, want to kill some turkeys, there's Bourbon Barrel Calls on social media as well.
Cool. I'll put all the links up in the show notes. And, and thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it. It was good to meet and blast having a chat.
Yeah. Well, and I've been meaning to point this out. I absolutely dig your logo. I've been staring at your hat the entire podcast. And I'm I dig that Focus logo.
Yeah. Cool, dude. Well, I appreciate it. Okay, man. Yeah. Thanks a lot, eh?
All right, brother.
Again, everyone, for tuning in to the Focus Hunting Podcast. It's coming at you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. Quick shout out to the sponsors of the show, Vortex Optics, the best in optics, period. Backroads Maps Books, never get lost with Backroads Maps. AKU Boots, you owe it to your feet. Scree Hunting Gear. Now, if you guys check the show notes, you're going to find some promo codes. Use them, save a bit. Love you guys. Talk to you soon.